Civil procedure in the modern Basin system, most of those words were chosen deliberately. Civil as opposed to criminal, civ pro as opposed to crim pro for the lawyers. Procedure, process of the law as opposed to substance of the law. Modern, we'll be focusing on how Basin actually functions today rather than how it functioned in Talmudic times. Basin is what we're talking about. System, the word system is a bit of a misnomer. The current Basin does not really work as much of a system as we'll discuss. Batei Din today are more or less independent. They're not hierarchical. They're not really linked. They don't operate under consistent standards, except, of course, for following halacha. We'll be discussing all of these dichotomies, what all these words mean as we go. That's just a general overview of what the title signifies. Now, what exactly is Basin? So in modern U.S. government, we have a tripartite system of government. We have the executive, the judicial, and the legislature. Basin, of course, corresponds more or less to the judicial branch, the branch that decides law, that tries cases, that interprets the law. It's not completely true that that was always Basin's exact role, certainly not in Talmudic times. If you go far enough back to the time of the Mishnah, the time of the Talmud, we do find that Basin had a role as did have some of the what we would consider a legislative function, for example, declarations of war. In times of Tanakh, as explained to us by the Talmud in early times, you would need the Sanhedrin. That was one of the systems of Basin, one of the types of Basin. Sanhedrin would be involved in a declaration of war. Today, we see that as a legislative function. Senate, sometimes the executive might do it on its own, but you know, we see that as a legislative function. But that was something that Basin used to be involved in, and so on and so forth, matters of national importance. Basin did have a legislative function, but even in Talmudic times, certainly in contemporary times, the vast majority today, pretty much all of Basin does is what we see as the judicial function, pretty much as a court does today, tries cases, criminal and civil cases. Now, again, in Talmudic times, the Basin heard both criminal and civil cases. Criminal cases are basically crimes against God, crimes against society. The plaintiff, if there is one, is the state, is the government. Somebody's on trial. He's the only one on trial. There's no other side. You're not judging the claims of two litigants. It's basically the state, as we call it today, trying a case against an individual. In Torah law, we call that ben adam l'makom, a crime, an avera between man and God, Sabbath desecration, idol worship. And, of course, there is an overlap between civil and criminal. A typical civil case would be you broke my window, you borrowed money, you didn't repay, you borrowed money, you haven't repaid. Basically, it's one litigant is asking for something from another litigant, asking typically for money. Sometimes you can be asking for an injunction. You can be asking for a cease and desist from some conduct. You can be arguing about divorce, about assets, about custody. But the idea of civil is that there are two litigants, two disputants. They're arguing about something, and the court has to adjudicate. And there is some overlap. For example, if someone kills someone, that can be a crime, murder, manslaughter, something like that. It can also be a civil case, wrongful death, where the heir is in a murder case or a wrongful death case, it would be the heirs would be asking for money. But then halacha too, we have similar notions. We have some overlap. There are certain types of crimes that can be both criminal and civil. In halacha, there are certain rules that govern the interplay. Kam le midrav mine, we're not going to get into that today. But in general, in Talmudic times, the Basin handled both criminal as well as civil cases. One of my favorite questions people ask me today is, do you do criminal cases? Do you execute people? The answer is no, we do not execute people in contemporary times. The Talmud itself says that capital punishment was basically abolished under Jewish law a couple of thousand years ago, but they didn't have not done criminal justice, formal criminal justice in that time. And today, pretty much the only domain in which Basin operates is the civil domain. Now, just to elaborate slightly on this point, the truth is that in halacha, there are really three types of cases. There are civil cases, which are typically about money, but they're about claims between two private parties. There are criminal cases. Criminal cases can be subdivided further into capital cases and everything else. Everything else is not that much else. Halacha doesn't really have any formal system of jail, or any kind of penal, any kind of confinement. What we do have is malchus, lashes, certain averas, eating chazer, eating pork, you would be subject to lashes in the Talmudic times. So in general, we can break up criminal into capital and everything else. Capital cases, much as they do in the modern system, have a particularly high standard, for evidence, for conviction. The Torah says, "Vitzilu ha'eda." There's a mitzvah. There's a very high value in not punishing an innocent person, certainly not with death. So capital cases have an exceptionally high standard for proof. Other criminal cases possibly have a lower standard. Civil cases commonly have the lowest standard. They are the most streamlined for various reasons, partly as a pragmatic concession. We need the marketplace to function efficiently. We need an effective system for quickly and efficiently adjudicating disputes, so we suspend some of the more rigorous requirements. Additionally, for reasons we'll explain later, there are other reasons why we can suspend some of the more onerous technical requirements in a civil case. But in general, as we've said, what we do today is by and large pretty much only civil. So we'll be focusing today on civil cases. Now, before we start, we should discuss what a beis din is from the perspective of secular law. We've been living for, again, thousands of years under civil law, since the exile, since the destruction of the temple, even before the destruction of the temple. Jewish society operated not as a sovereign nation. In earlier generations, certainly in the medieval period, the Jewish communities had much more autonomy, and the batei din, the internal communal structures, therefore had much more control, much more autonomy. They could do much more. Today we have much less. But it is constant that we have been operating for many centuries under a secular regime, under a non-Jewish regime, and batei din had to somehow find their place within that system. They had to somehow find a modus vivendi with secular law. Batei din, courts, Jewish courts. That has evolved over the years. For the last several centuries, under the modern Western style of government, under modern government, batei din have operated essentially as arbitration tribunals. Modern Western governments recognize what they call ADR, alternative dispute resolution. The courts are very happy if private litigants in civil cases can resolve their disputes without recourse to the court system. It helps unclog the court's workload, makes people happier in general. So there's an entire area called ADR, alternative dispute resolution, which includes several different modalities. It includes arbitration, it includes mediation. Mediation basically is somebody enters as a mediator, tries to help the two parties reach a decision on their own. He kind of catalyzes it, he helps them out, but ultimately they reach the decision. Arbitration means that the two litigants, the two disputants, submit their dispute to an arbitrator. There's binding arbitration, there's non-binding arbitration, but arbitration basically means that a decision will be laid down from the arbitrator, imposed by the arbitrator upon the two parties. It can be, again, binding or non-binding. All these different modalities fall under the rubric of ADR. Courts are, the law, courts are very happy to have litigants resolve their disputes in this fashion. Obviously, both parties have to agree. Everyone has the right, in the great states of America, the right to his day in court. Generally, you can't be forced into ADR. It's called alternative. It's not the default. But in general, it's a good idea, often. More and more, it has become common in certain contexts for contracts to bind the parties to arbitration. Many modern credit cards will have a clause saying any dispute, both parties agree, will be handled by arbitration much cheaper often, much faster. Whether it's totally fair or not, I'm not an expert in this, but in general, many types of modern contracts will force parties into arbitration. Very often, even a private contract between two people, a real estate contract, will have a clause: any dispute shall go to arbitration. So batei din operate under state arbitration statutes. Now, people are often surprised to hear, in a country where you need a license to be a hairdresser sometimes, you don't need any sort of license, any sort of certification to be an arbitrator. As long as the two parties are content by having a particular body or a particular individual or a group of individuals adjudicate their disputes, that is fine. As long as they agree, you have to agree, but as long as they agree, the court is perfectly happy to let them decide. No, the court doesn't want to know what their qualifications are. The court doesn't want to know what system they're using for making decisions. The court doesn't want to know anything. The court does want to know that the process involves fundamental fairness. The way arbitration works under state law is that the arbitrator hands down a decision. The court will then enforce it. One party, the winning party, typically can take it to court and say, I would like the court to ratify this and enforce this. I mean, if the other side is not listening, obviously, that's what you'll have to do. The court will then pretty much agree. The other side can contest it on the grounds that his basic due process rights were not upheld. He can't say, I disagree with the halacha. He can't say, I think a different resolution should have been reached. Typically, the only thing he can do to get it overturned, to get it not honored, will be to show that his basic procedural rights were violated, which is an uphill battle. It can be done. You can say, for example, they refused to notify me of the date and they held a hearing in my absence. You can say they refused to let me bring a lawyer. Having a lawyer, again, great old states of America, having a lawyer is a fundamental right. That's why we'll discuss this further as we go. That's why most Batei Din typically will allow counsel, whether they're happy about it or grumble about it, they typically will allow parties to bring counsel. One part of the reason is, I understand, is that the right to counsel, the right to representation, is considered a pretty fundamental right. So the court will want to know that certain basic procedural protections were upheld. They also can occasionally throw out a decision if they just think it's completely unreasonable. This is a fairly controversial area. Every now and then you'll hear about a Beis Din verdict that was tossed out because a judge decided that he simply cannot fathom how they would have arrived at such a conclusion. That is considered a fairly controversial thing to do. Those things are often reversed on appeal. Because again, the default presumption under the law is that the law is not here to second guess the substance of the law, the substance of halacha or anything else. The law doesn't want to know. As long as the parties agreed, as long as there were no undisclosed conflicts of interest and so on, the law typically will require the parties to follow what they arbitrate, what they've agreed to as arbitration. Now, in recent years, in the US and Canada, I think has gone even further, there's been some movement by ultra-conservative types, by anti-Muslim types, to ban Sharia, even in arbitration. Some people are so scared of Sharia that they've passed state laws saying you can arbitrate, you can decide however you want, but not based on Sharia, not based on foreign religion. The Aguda, actually, and some Jewish advocacy groups have fiercely opposed that because taking away the rights of arbitrators to apply any set of rules they want, including religious law, means that the power of Beis Din to operate as arbitrators can be potentially severely hampered, severely hindered, and the firm organizations do not like that. But in general, so far, in most U.S. jurisdictions, as far as I understand, Beis Din can operate under any rules it wants, as long as there's proper disclosure to the litigants, and the court will typically uphold a Beis Din verdict. That's why Batei Din, we don't have to be certified, we don't have to have any kind of formal qualifications. As long as the parties agree to accept us, we can operate. Actually, when I was in Lakewood, some of my colleagues and I, we actually attended a seminar on ADR by a professor, someone who's taught this at the law school level, with role-playing, great fun for everyone, playing and practicing negotiation, practicing arbitration. So training can't hurt, certainly. You know, there are certainly skills you can learn. There's certainly practical skills, you know, how to persuade people to do what you want, how to make them happy about it, how to do effective arbitration, effective mediation. Certainly can't hurt. I'm not against qualifications, but from a legal perspective, there is no need for any kind of formal certification. And that's how we operate. And this goes back, as I said, this goes back to Europe at least a century or two ago. We find Batei Din operated under legal regimes that they refer to in Hebrew as compromise, kuf aleph mem, resh aleph mem, pei resh, and so on and so forth. And this is an old tradition already under modern Western governments for Batei Din to operate as arbitrators. So typically, when you bring a case to a Beis Din, you will sign both a legally binding arbitration agreement as well as a halakhically designed agreement to accept the authority of the Beis Din. It can be one document if you can be clever enough to write it in one format that satisfies both systems of requirements. It can be two documents, but either way, the point is we operate duly. Internally, we operate as a Beis Din. Externally, we operate as arbitration. Now, Batei Din, from the Jewish perspective, there are basically three kinds of Batei Din. There are communal organizations, whether they have formal governmental sanction, which is basically only in Israel you'll find today, where the city will have an authorized Beis Din by the government, but part of the rabbinate system. You can have a kind of informal communal Beis Din. For example, here in Greater Washington, we have the Vaad of Greater Washington has Beis Din services which are provided. They are pretty much the communal representation here. They are of the Orthodox community, and that's the Beis Din pretty much of the community. Baltimore has the Orthodox community has a Beis Din. That is the communal Beis Din model. There is a private standing Beis Din. When I was in Lakewood, for example, my organization operated as a private Beis Din. We operated for years, but we had no presumptions to be the official communal Beis Din. We were simply a private organization providing services to those who desired without any city official or even unofficial position within the community. Then there is the ad hoc Beistin, known by the unlovely acronym of ZABLA, Zion Beis Lamed Aleph in Hebrew. It stands for Ze Bar Lo Echad, an institution we'll perhaps return to a little bit later. Basically, it is a procedure followed where each party selects on an ad hoc basis for their specific case one dayan, and those two, with or without the cooperation of the litigants themselves, select a third one to be called the shlish. That's basically a special tribunal, not a standing based, in a special tribunal form to hear a specific case, and they hear the case in question, then they dissolve and they go back to their regular lives. So all three of these bate din in different forms operate today. There are differences in the halacha, both as a matter of custom as well as a matter of formal halacha, in how they operate. We'll perhaps discuss some of the differences as we go, but these are the three types of bate din that operate. Many dayanim will wear multiple hats, will sit on multiple organizations, will participate in Zavla, will also sit on a communal beis din, and you know, it depends on the policies of the beis din, whether they allow that kind of moonlighting or not, but in principle, there's no real objection. There's no real objection to that. Now, one other question people often want to know about for good reason is cost. How much does a beis din cost? So in halacha, of course, a beis din is not supposed to charge money. This goes back to Talmudic times. Beis din is not allowed to charge anything. First of all, of course, there are the anti-corruption halachos about bribery, lo sikach shocha. The Torah is pretty clear about that. That's been extended by rabbinic law and the Talmud much, much further than the bare biblical law. But beyond all the questions of corruption, there is an additional halacha that a beis din is not supposed to charge money because it is providing a religious service, it is doing a mitzvah, and those who do mitzvahs are not supposed to charge money. Of course, that means that a teacher of Torah is not supposed to charge money, and before anyone gets on his or her high horse, that means a doctor is not supposed to charge money. Obviously, we do, that's also a mitzvah, certainly, healing people. We obviously do not follow any of these halachas. They have not been followed pretty much for centuries, not with regard to Batei Din, not with regard to teachers of Torah, not with regard to physicians. And in each of these disciplines, Poskim have struggled for centuries trying to find rationalizations, justifications for charging. But again, we're not going to get into all the details of why they charge, but the consensus, certainly the standard practice accepted grudgingly or not by the Poskim, is that all these practitioners of mitzvah, of other things, do charge money, and it is accepted, but they didn't do charge. How much they charge varies by organization. There's no standard fee schedule. Typically, communal Bate Din might charge less than some of the private organizations do, but even the communal Bate Din are trying to cover their basic costs, so difficult to give rules. You know, if anyone has a dentari, it's possible to find out, either by, that's one of the things council can advise you on that, but they do charge. Sometimes people think the charges are high. People often point out they're probably a lot less than litigation in court, although you still might be paying both your counsel and the beis din, but by and large, given that the process will usually be shorter and more efficient than a court case, as I understand it, you still will probably come out ahead by paying less in beis din than you will in secular court. Now, my organization back in Lakewood actually had a policy that we did charge a basic amount, although the dayanim themselves did not receive any of that money. We operated purely on a volunteer basis. We were all either some of us were rabbis, some of us were private citizens in Kollel, but we, you know, all volunteered very much on a pro bono basis to do work for the beis din. So as a further kind of hedge against corruption, a further barrier against corruption, we did not take any of the money directly or even indirectly from the work we did. That is not always the practice, it's not usually the practice, but that was an extra step we took. But Batei Din typically do charge. A beis din case begins in one of two ways, similar in some ways to the way a court case works. It can either work by both parties approaching the beis din and say, we would both like to have our case resolved by you, please schedule us. Or in a case which is less amicable, beis din can issue a summons. The institution of a summons is something that has no meaning under secular law. Secular law, you're not obligated to answer a summons by some non-governmental body. But in halacha, the summons is a serious thing. A person who receives a summons from a beis din is supposed to answer it. The answer does not have to be acquiescence to go to that beis din. The defendant, the person, the recipient of the summons, has the right to say, I want a different venue. And the rules for venue selection are extremely complicated and often highly contested in the prelude to a din Torah went beyond the scope of our talk today. That, again, is one of the things counsel can be invaluable in guiding someone through I don't want to say you, I don't want to imply that anyone is ever going to be in Basin, but counsel can be invaluable in, not that going to Basin is a bad thing, just people sometimes would rather not have the hassle of it, but counsel can be invaluable in helping someone make a decision, you explain the different characteristics of different Batei Din. And the truth is, choosing a Beis Din while forum shopping gets a bad rap sometimes and often can be a source of corruption or a source of inappropriate behavior, finding a Beis Din that works for you is a good thing. Finding a Beis Din that you feel you can communicate with, that will understand you, that you feel you can respect is obviously an important thing. We want litigants to feel one of the key values of Beis Din, key points that Beis Din is supposed to hold up is not just fairness, but is the appearance of fairness, avoiding any even implication of conflict of interest or of lack of impartiality. It is really important that the litigants should feel that the Beis Din understands them and listens to them and gave them a fair hearing, and therefore it is appropriate that people should find. So, for example, if you have an American person doesn't speak a word of Yiddish and he's going to appear before a Hasidic Beis Din, the Hasidic Batei Din are some of the best in the country. Rabbi Avraham Baruch Rosenberg, of Muncie, Machon Lahara. I've had people who have been before them who have respected them across the spectrum, from staunch Lithuanian YU types to businessmen, to Hasidim, to professionals. They're very, very good, but if you feel there's a cultural gap and they won't understand you and you won't understand them, not the right venue for you. So when you receive a summons, when someone receives a summons, you should choose a venue and respond either yes, I will come to you, or no, I'll go somewhere else. If the parties cannot agree on a venue after this kind of negotiation, what happens eventually is Zavla, the institution we mentioned earlier, where each party that's kind of the lowest common denominator, where each party selects one dayan, and between the two of them, they will select a third. Many higher profile, higher stakes, more acrimonious cases do end up at Zavla, just the nature of the system. Now, counsel. We've repeatedly mentioned the idea of having counsel in a Beis Din situation. So, there's a long and tortured history in halacha about whether counsel plays any role. We don't find in Talmudic times we don't really find much direct discussion of advocacy or of counsel. We don't find typically that litigants, in the few anecdotal stories we have of Beis Din proceedings, we don't typically find the presence of counsel. I actually gave a talk to my night call about this recently. We're learning Hilchos Dayanim. So we discussed the idea of having counsel in Beis Din. So in modern Hebrew, the word for a lawyer is an orech din. In Talmudic times, the word appears in perhaps a dozen or two instances all over the Talmud, Midrashic literature, Talmud, Mishnah, commonly in a pejorative context, not always, as one of the modern scholars of Mishpat Ivri has pointed out, one of the most beloved and venerable piyutim for the High Holy Days is Lekel Orech Din. We refer to God as an Orech Din, which presumably is not a pejorative thing. In the Mishnah Pirkei Avos, for example, it's pejorative, Al Tas Ashmcha Karche Adayanim, do not act as a lawyer, if that's what the word means. There actually is a theory that, among some scholars, that Orche Adayanim actually is using the Greek, I guess, root. It really means arch, like don't be like an arch dayan, which means don't be too high and mighty, don't think you're the greatest thing since sliced bread. But the general chat in most of halakhic literature is that Orche Adayanim means lawyers, and that being a lawyer is a bad thing. There are a few Talmudic contexts in which the Gemara seems to imply that lawyers are bad. There is one Gemara in Shabbos which definitely hurls invective at corrupt lawyers, but again, the impression is corrupt lawyers as opposed to honest lawyers. The Gemara brings a pasuk in Yeshaya who's castigating the iniquities of his generation. So he talks about a pasuk, Yudechem Nigalu Badam, your hands are dripping blood and you're soiled with this and that. So Chazal say, have a drasha, each of the words in the pasuk, four categories. One of them refers to Dayanim, one of them refers to Sofri Adayanim, the scribes or the secretaries, one refers to the Arche Adayanim, the lawyers, and one refers to the litigants themselves. So the lawyers are put in the same category. They were all corrupt. The judges were corrupt, the litigants were dishonest, the scribes were corrupt, the lawyers were corrupt, so they were corrupt as everyone else was, but it doesn't imply that they were somehow worse than the Dayanim themselves. It's a good question. There are commentators who do interpret the root. Again, the word Arche Adayanim in Talmudic literature is very unclear, very obscure. There are some theories that it is connected to Arkos. Yes, I don't have all the pshatim off the top of my head, but there definitely are those who have made the connection. Again, it's such an obscure phrase that people have tried all kinds of things to make sense out of it. But there is, in general, a notion that counsel is inappropriate, that it leads to it can lead to perversions of the din. Shocking thought, right? Whoever heard that a lawyer can possibly do anything but serve the interest of truth, justice, and the American way. When I gave this little talk to my night call, so I mentioned the notorious line from, I think, Henry VI, where they're plotting revolution, and one of them says, first, we'll kill all the lawyers. Some of the lawyers have been very offended by this and have reinterpreted that line to mean that lawyers are the protectors of order and justice, and these guys were criminals and dastardly villains who were trying to overthrow just government, so we can only do that if you first get rid of the guardians of peace and justice. That is not what the phrase means. The consensus is they were promising there'll be no money, everyone will get food, then we'll kill all the lawyers. The real impression was nobody liked lawyers, they were a necessary evil, we have to have them, but these utopian scoundrels were getting rid of the lawyers. Halacha does not like lawyers, yet lawyers, again, are accepted today in modern Batei Din. One of the reasons, as I mentioned earlier, is perhaps because we want to make sure that our proceedings are upheld under grounds of basic procedural fairness. Another reason is, mentioned earlier, that civil procedure in halacha has more relaxed standards than other areas of Beis Din. One of the reasons is, and this is basically a cardinal rule throughout Hilchos Dayanim, throughout the laws of Beis Din procedure, is that when it comes to monetary matters, when it comes to civil disputes, it's your money, you can do with it what you want. So a person can pretty much waive most of the halachas, most of the formal rules in Hilchos Dayanim and the laws of Beis Din in civil matters can be waived by the parties. That as long as they know and they willingly, either deliberately or even implicitly, either explicitly or even implicitly decide that we are willing to waive certain halachas, certain cases of basic civil rights, basic procedural rights, they have the right to waive them. And some poskim have argued that this is, I've heard Rav Yashuv, Zichrono Livracha, has said this, that the litigants have the right to waive, each one theoretically has the right to say, I don't want you bringing counsel because he's just going to make trouble. But the way the system works, both parties understand that counsel will be brought, both parties tacitly accept it, and that's a waiver. Wherever the justification is, counsel is used today. It is not required. The Beis Din, as we've said earlier, is not designed to be an adversarial system where two learned counsels are arguing the law. We do allow it, but in theory we consider it, and hopefully in practice too, we consider it the Beis Din's responsibility to know the law, know the halacha, and apply it properly. We're not that arrogant that we don't welcome counsel who wishes to bring sources, halachic sources, other sources to our attention. We welcome any help we can get, but we don't rely on them. We're not entering a court case assuming that they're going to make any legal arguments that need to be made. We are assuming that we will make whatever legal arguments need to be made. If counsel or a learned litigant himself wants to bring up halachic arguments, that's his right, and we're very happy to listen, but we don't require that. We don't necessarily even encourage that. Now, people can bring counsel for a variety of reasons, both to make halachic arguments, sometimes simply because a person might be flustered or tongue-tied in court. Sometimes a person might just be shy. Sometimes a person might just not be a good debater, might not be well-organized, articulate. I remember before I first joined the Beis Din, I had the general kind of academic negative attitude toward counsel. I witnessed my first inter. I came out of there shaking my head and said, I think we should require counsel. The person was just so disorganized, he just couldn't answer a question. I don't think he was dishonest, but anytime we asked him a question, please tell us what happened in the conversation of May 22nd, he would be like, the reason I'm so upset is because it's not fair, because I trusted him and he betrayed me. Like, okay, we understand this point, but we need to address a specific factual question. He's like, well, you have to understand the context. It started 4 years before that when I first met him on the train. Like, we understand that, but we also have to have answers. The context is important too, but we also have to have answers to certain concrete points. Sometimes, counsel or someone used to Beis Din can just help the client get a little more organized. I remember once, there's always a danger when you're a professional, when you're used to something, of expecting everyone else to know what you know, and it's not fair. Obviously, we have no expectation that laymen have anything to do with Beis Din, know anything about Beis Din, but certain things you just think are common sense. I remember once a plaintiff came in, basic civil case, two businesses, an argument about goods provided and not paid for. So the plaintiff said, I provided equipment to defendant's establishment over a period of years. I provided tens of thousands of dollars of equipment, and I haven't been paid on my account as an arrears significantly. We listened to his claim. We described what kind of equipment he was talking about. We asked him, okay, how much equipment was there? What is the sum total, and how much are you asking for? He said, I don't know. I have to talk to my accountant. So my jaw dropped. You're the plaintiff. It's not like you're the defendant and you don't know what you're being sued for. You brought the case. You scheduled it. Didn't it occur to you that a basic question the basement might ask you is, how much money are you asking for and what exactly do you want? Isn't that like common sense that a basement would need to know that? But I guess not. I guess not everyone. I guess he thought it was the basement's job maybe to go through his paperwork and figure out. So things like that, sometimes counsel can perhaps help and help you prepare, help you organize your material, help you just smooth things along a little bit. Which brings us to another point, actually. Court cases have discovery, pretrial discovery, where people will give things to each other, give things to the court before Basin. I'm not a lawyer, I don't know the parameters of that, but basic idea that there's such a thing as pretrial discovery. Basin does not formally have any such system. Not only that, but halacha actually, some poskim explicitly state that a litigant cannot even be forced to divulge too much detail of his claim.
Ruven can tell
Shimon, I am suing you in Beis Din. Shimon says, what for? Ruven says, I'll see you in court and you'll find out more details. It sounds bizarre to some people. Some people think, like, doesn't it make sense to have some kind of discussion so I can prepare, I can bring my papers? Nevertheless, there are poskim who say that we want all the discussion and debate to take place in court under controlled circumstances, and we cannot force a litigant to reveal too much of his claim before the case. Bate Din will have different policies in what they actually do. In my experience, most Bate Din do not require much in the way of disclosure. We'll accept disclosure. If parties want, we'll even encourage it. If parties want to make things available, that's great. We typically don't require much in the way of disclosure. I personally think that requiring more disclosure would be a good idea. And again, even if halacha doesn't require it, as we've said repeatedly, the cardinal rule of modern Beis Din is that parties have the right to waive some of their rights. I personally think it probably would be a good idea to have parties agree to do some level of disclosure. It would make things so much simpler. Like in that previous case I mentioned, if Beis Din knows what they're going to be talking about, to explain to them, if you're arguing about a real estate dispute, we would like to have the contract involved. They're just, you know, basic common sense things. It would help sometimes to tell them. Sometimes it can take weeks to track down documents. So if we tell them we're going to need this, we won't have to wait 3 weeks after the case before we get essential documents. But in general, discovery is not normally required by halacha. You'll typically walk in for the first time and begin laying out your case in Beis Din. Rules of evidence, another big topic in Beis Din. The rules of evidence work in some ways. There are some very close similarities to modern court systems, and in some ways it is very different. One kind of minor but very remarkable similarity is the law of hearsay. I remember when my wife was studying for the bar, so I remember hearsay is unbelievably complicated in law. There are 25 rules and then 26 exceptions to each one of the rules. My wife was sitting there like a mantra going through, if it was an excited utterance and said by this under these circumstances, then we have an exception to hearsay. If one of the 45 cases in which hearsay will be admitted in certain types of cases and so on. Halacha also has a rule against hearsay. It is called aid mipi aid. We do not typically allow one witness to repeat what he heard from another witness if it isn't firsthand. We also have exceptions. Maybe less complicated, maybe more complicated in some ways in the law, but in general, one major difference in the rules of evidence in halacha, broadly speaking, than in court procedure is that anyone who's watched a courtroom drama or read a courtroom novel will know that the lawyers spend a lot of time, say, yelling objection. We don't want someone to say something, we don't want something to be introduced. Halacha doesn't really work under that system of raising objections. We typically, as a matter of practice, certainly, we can argue what the traditional version was, but certainly the way Beis Din works today, we don't object to things generally. We typically allow litigants to bring, to introduce pretty much anything they want, and then we sort out the wheat from the chaff separately in our deliberations. Privately, we decide what's relevant and what's not. We will occasionally block something from being introduced if we feel that the potential for creating, let's say, fistfights erupting in the Beis Din is higher than the likelihood of anything useful being coming out. Like if one of them is going to start calling somebody names and then arguing about some trivial point which has nothing to do with the case except for getting them angry at each other, we will say, you know, not material, let's move on. But in general, we will not say, even in cases like we said, aid me p8 of hearsay, we will not typically say, not relevant, not admissible, let's move on. We'll typically say, we'll listen to everything you have to say and we will decide afterwards. In court cases involving juries, the judges spend a lot of time protecting juries from hearing certain things. We don't want you to hear this, it's prejudicial, they can call a mistrial if the jury hears something that they shouldn't have heard. Halacha doesn't work like that. We don't have juries. Should have mentioned this earlier, I suppose. Halacha has no notion of jury. Judges decide everything, questions of law, questions of fact. Judges will have to consult, slight digression here, judges will consult experts. We are not experts in quite a wide variety of disciplines. I remember one of our all-time funniest cases we had in Lakewood. We dealt with pretty small cases. Our fees were low. We had dealt with big cases too, but our fees were low. We tried to be efficient. We once had a case, a dispute between a Shetelmacher and a client. Client had ordered a wig from a seller or designer of wigs, whatever she was exactly. She had ordered a specific form of wig. She had characterized and described it in certain ways. She felt that the delivered product did not match the description in her order. And the Shetelmacher, the defendant, felt that it did. The specific dispute, I believe, hinged around the meaning of the word stringy as applied to hair. Customer felt that the hair was unacceptably stringy. Defendant felt that this was the normal deliverable under a contract that specified human hair, whatever it was. So these two women were arguing in court for an hour about whether this hair, they brought it in as an exhibit, they brought the Shetel in, and they were arguing whether this hair was appropriately unstringy or not. So after about an hour of this, the three bearded rabbis, turned to the litigants and said, we will freely admit we are not experts in the stringiness of shekels. If you cannot reach a resolution, if we cannot reach some kind of compromise here, we are going to have to do the only thing possible, which is hire an expert or consult a neutral shekelmacher. Difference between experts in halacha and law is that in law, experts are commonly provided by the two sides. My wife, who used to work for big law, one of her jobs, working in pharmaceutical litigation, one of her jobs was calling up experts on behalf of her client and saying, here's $30,000 plus whatever, and will you testify what we need you to testify? We're not asking you to lie, but we're asking if you believe whatever you believe, will you feel comfortable testifying in court that as the head of this and this of that, you've published 16 articles on the topic, your expert opinion, this scientific position is true. So we do allow litigants to bring their own experts, as they do in courts of law. However, we don't require it. We consider that Basin's job. And in a case involving expertise, we will consult outside experts. If we can find one to do it as a favor, pro bono for us, great. You know, if we have to pay somebody, we will, and we'll bill the cost to the litigants. So we do have experts. We're not experts in many things, certainly. In, let's say, child custody cases, but they didn't do handle divorce cases. They'll handle things like custody. Social workers may have to be consulted. People who, mental health professionals may have to be consulted. We have a close family friend I mentioned who has a very healthy respect for the Hasidic Batei Din. He's a distinguished clinical psychologist. He's been called in by Batei Din to testify about, I don't know the details, obviously, but about fitness of parents, about health of children. And obviously, Basin is not, they're not psychologists. They can't, a case requiring psychology, they'll have to get expert opinion. So we have experts, we have testimony, we'll typically allow everything and make decisions after the fact. We often, as I said before, we won't have all the requisite documentation. We will have to ask for more, we'll have to have follow-ups. And as I said, we allow everything. We typically, halacha does have rules. Anyone who has studied a broad swath of Talmudic passages will be familiar with rules about Shnei Edim, the gold standard of two witnesses, which of course everyone points out is very much not considered the gold standard of proof under modern criminology. Certainly human witnesses are simply not that reliable. But in halacha, we treat human witnesses as the gold standard. One witness, invalid witnesses, formal, informal. But even today, typically, as I said, accept all evidence and make a decision largely, to a large extent, based on their sense, their judgment, what a jury would do of what actually happened. Why we're justified to do this is a difficult question. Partly this is because, again, go back to the same cardinal rule that we sign waivers in the beginning of the Dinei Torah, that we allow the judges certain latitude to operate in ways beyond that strictly required by the halacha. One of those things often is that we allow the litigants, allow the judges certain latitude to make findings of fact, to establish realia, even in cases where that are apart from beyond the formal standards of the halacha. One very interesting question I've actually discussed here in the past from this podium, I think, is modern forensic evidence, things like DNA, other types of modern forensic evidence. Halacha generally does have a kind of, by and large, common sense attitude toward these types of things. If the science is good and reliable, halacha typically will consider such evidence admissible. We certainly, in civil cases, where again the standards are more streamlined, even in cases which are ritual matters, like permitting an aguna to remarry by establishing a husband's death, There's a pretty strong consensus of poskim that allows it. Certainly in civil cases, we would allow DNA evidence. The common application of that is in paternity cases, where you're trying to establish, for child support purposes, you're trying to establish paternity, where we will often, courts in Israel, Bat Yadin in Israel, repeatedly have been using a paternity test to establish or to rule out paternity. There's actually an interesting little body of literature on polygraphs, on lie detector tests. Do lie detector tests have any role in Beis Din? Hard to know, and the poskim, it's hard to know when you read the poskim what they were told, what they thought about the reliability of polygraph tests. So for example, I think fairly representative and fairly reasonable is the position of Rav Avadia Yosef. He wrote a tshuva probably a couple of decades ago. He was asked about lie detector tests, and he absolutely rules them out as having any significant probative value. He says they're simply not reliable enough. He says, now presciently, wisely, he adds a caveat. He says, technology advances, and if at some point in the future the test will be proven, the test will develop and advance, never make an assumption about what science can do. I mean, if science will reach a stage where the tests are very reliable, we'll obviously have to revisit the issue. I don't think we're quite there yet. One of the earlier tshuvas, Rabbi Baumel of the U.S., actually his tshuva deals with both lie detector tests as well as what he calls truth serum, test resh vav test samach resh vav mem. My understanding is that still to a large extent science fiction. I don't know. Obviously there are drugs that can alter certainly they appear in science fiction context and thriller context. I don't know how practical they are for use in court cases yet, to stick somebody in the chair and inject him and say, now you will tell us what we want to know. But in any event, again, the halacha I think follows, certainly in civil cases, a kind of common sense rule here, which is that to the extent that something is very, very reliable, the discussion about DNA testing, I discussed this once here before, the post who allow it quote numbers with lots and lots of zeros about the odds of a coincidence, of a false match, are very, very low. Postcom typically will allow it. Yes?
Does modern Beis Din allow women to be witnesses, or are they excluded?
That's a good question. So as I mentioned earlier, the modern Beis Din, we don't operate on the principle of excluding anyone a priori. We will typically allow anyone to testify, certainly women. A woman's testimony will be given weight, as I said, because we often make decisions largely based on our sense of what actually happened rather than the formal rules of evidence. There are certain cases, as we've said earlier, our case is about civil procedure, our talk today. There are certain cases where witnesses are required in a more ritual context. For example, two witnesses at a marriage, for example, which are necessary for the solemnization of a marriage, still have to be men. And there are certain cases where there are specific ritual significance where the exclusion of women is still maintained. But in general, in civil cases, we certainly hear testimony from women. We hear testimony from people of all religions, of all nationalities, of all, we accept pretty much anyone, and we make a decision accordingly. Verdict is handed down typically in writing, although there isn't a formal rule about that. It can be delivered orally. Sometimes if a decision is needed in an immediately, time is of the essence, we will issue a verbal ruling. Written can be printed, dead tree, paper, email, fax. It doesn't make much of a difference. The question of how much argument, how much reasoning and rationale is included in a verdict is a very controversial one. Historically and halakhically, the Beis Din is not generally required to include a lot of detail about how they arrived at their conclusions. It is sometimes done, particularly in Israel, where the system developed to operate, as we'll discuss a little bit further in a moment, the system developed to operate on a more Western model, but they didn't do issue elaborate, detailed rulings. And some of these published collections of rulings in Israel are some of the most valuable resources for the working dayan or the working student of Chosh and Mishpat. They have the flagship collection of something called Piskei Adin, Shel Batei Hadin, HaRabaniyim Be'eretz Yisrael. There's some 20 plus volumes, some 6,000 plus pages of case files, including some of the greatest dayanim in Eretz Yisrael over the last 50 years, Rav Eliashiv, Rav Waldenberg, Rav Yosef, Rav Kapach, Rav Zolti, and so on and so forth. But in America, that varies by the Beis Din. Again, as I said, no real system, but they didn't operate on their own principles. But they didn't will include more or less reasoning, more or less rationale at their discretion. Last point we have time for, which again goes back, is closely related to this question of writing down reasoning as well as to the question of system, is appeal. What is somebody's recourse if he's not happy with the verdict of a Beis Din? So, a lot has been written about the history of appeal, the history of reviewing the decision of a Beis Din. In the Talmudic times, it doesn't seem there was any organized system to that effect. There are a few ambiguous Talmudic passages which imply that there might have been, but there's certainly nothing clear, nothing really clear in the Shulchan Aruch about it. In Parshas Yisro, where Yisro talks about a system of Sarei Alafim, Sarei Meos, Sarei Chamishim, Sarei Asaros, there is an opinion that that was a hierarchical system of appeal. Sfarno, I believe, says that, but that's a minority opinion. We don't find in any general, we don't find any real halakhic literature on an appellate system. There were Batei Din that had, there were communities, there were, we find historical evidence, there were communities that established some, but it doesn't really have, make any appearance in the formal halakhic literature of an organized, halakhically sanctioned system of appeal. In the modern Beis Din, in Eretz Yisrael, the Rabbanut system does have an appellate process. They have a Beit Din Le'erurim, a Beit Din Hagadol, Batei Din for appeal. This was a great fight that began in Israel about a century ago, about 1920, several decades before the state, where the British, who were allowing the mandatory yishuv to have a Beis Din system, but the British very much wanted it to be Western in certain ways. One of the ways they wanted was accountability, and they wanted an appellate system. So the Rabbanim had a fierce argument about it. Rav Kook was one of the ones who strongly supported it. Many other Rabbanim were very much against it. And there was a fight about it, but eventually it did become accepted, even before the state, certainly after the state. There is a system of appealing a Beis Din on a civil case, certainly in Eretz Yisrael. As Rav Waldenberg and Rav Yosef both say, when they discuss it, they say it's become well accepted, whatever the original historical battles were. Since Eliezer says even the most extreme Haredim attend to participate in this appellate system, and the great Rabbanim, some of the greatest Dayanim, as I mentioned earlier, the greatest Dayanim in Eretz Yisrael often sat on the appellate Beis Din. They apparently condoned it. There is a system of appeals in Eretz Yisrael. That also does carry, is closely connected to the idea of giving a written explanation of a verdict, because a Beis Din can't really review without understanding details of the case and what the verdict was. So in Israel, they do both issue Western-style reasoned verdicts with concurrences, with dissents, and they do have an appellate system. In the U.S., verdicts are often given without any kind of written explanation. There is no formal appellate system. Many Batei Din have their own internal appellate process. For example, here in Greater Washington, the Beis Din does have a procedure for an internal appeals process. The Beis Din of America, I know, has one involving adding additional, in both cases, there are additional or instead of, they have other dayanim from within the Beis Din. Most Batei Din today operate with pools of a number of dayanim. A Beis Din typically has three members. I should have said this earlier. You can use less, frowned upon. For good reason, sometimes Beis Din will do it if it's very delicate and requires a high degree of privacy. In general, a Beis Din should have three, may have more, sometimes they go up to five. But in general, so here in Greater Washington, the procedure is two more dayanim are added to the initial panel, and they hear in an expanded panel, they rehear some aspects of the case. In the Beis Din of America, I think it's one of the leaders of the Beis Din who looks at the case, Rav Willig perhaps, or Rav Schachter. But in general, but they didn't set their own policies. We typically ask the litigants in the initial agreement to wait, to accept that our decision is final, is unreviewable, may not be reheard anywhere else. It's both a question of fairness to the other litigant as well as respect for the Beis Din. We typically bar them from going anywhere else. There are some, what a Beis Din will do if presented with a case heard by another Beis Din and asked to review it will very much vary by the Beis Din. The Batei Din I've worked with have been adamant about not interfering, respecting the prerogatives of another Beis Din to decide cases. We would be reluctant or completely unwilling to look at something handled by another Beis Din. There are Batei Din with different policies. Some of the argument going back already five centuries to the time of the Beis Yosef, the 16th century, the Gemara has a principle that we give another Beis Din the benefit of the doubt that they know what they're doing. Some say that even if that was true, we always have an assumption that we're not as good as they used to be, and today, Batei Din are not so great, so today we have the right to review. Others say, no, well, that goes both ways. The second Beis Din is also not so great. So in order for the system to work, you have to respect the first Beis Din. That is the position that I've been trained in, that a Beis Din should not be willy-nilly, or even not willy-nilly, reviewing another Beis Din. In Israel, they have such a system, and one of the main justifications, again, in civil matters is buy-in. That's how the system works. The litigants agree going in. They understand that's how the system works, and they give their tacit or explicit permission to do it because that's how the system is designed. But here in America, it's less common, and again, sometimes it can have aspect to the Wild West, but they can do whatever they want. But the tradition in which I'm trained is that a Beis Din should be respecting the decisions of another Beis Din.